sort of aiming towards a little movie that I hopefully will manage to get played, set up on the laptop. But it's showing how some of the interesting problems in gravitational physics today are actually solved by numerical integration. And so the aim, ultimately, is to show a movie of a really nice numerical integration, which you'll see illustrates some quite interesting things about gravitational evolution. And in the sort of journey, or the en route to that, I also want to talk about perturbation theory in general relativity, because a lot of problems that you need to examine, you actually need to approach via perturbation theory. So it's an analytic tool which can either be used in its own right or alongside a numerical development. And I think it's quite useful to see how it's done and to sort of flag up some of the issues when you do perturbation theory. And it'll also bring me to talking about similarities and differences with higher dimensional gravity. So I'll sort of talk about things like degrees of freedom of the graviton. And then finally, or perhaps to start with, I want to just discuss about the black hole singularity and this idea in classical general relativity of cosmic censorship. So we've, in talking about black holes, I've said that there's a singularity at R equals zero. I've drawn it both in the Kruskals as well as on Penrose diagrams. And I've mentioned about the fact that if the idea of this event horizon of the black hole being a global property of the space-time, but also a local notion of apparent horizons. And this idea that you can have a situation where no matter which way you shine your torch, all the light is being sucked inwards. It's convergent. So that's a notion of a trapped surface. And so what cosmic censorship is, it was a proposal or a hypothesis put forward by Penrose in the 60s that singularities, apart from the initial cosmic singularity, would be censored. They would always be hidden behind an event horizon. So let's just put down a few bullet points in the thought process here. So the first thing is that with general relativity, singularities generically occur. So it's actually not difficult to find solutions which have singularities. And in particular, there are a series of theorems by Penrose and Hawking which say that, more or less to paraphrase them, if you have one of these circumstances where your both ingoing and outgoing null geodesics are convergent, so we call this trapped surface, so I'm not being precise here. I'm simply giving a heuristic rundown of the content. If you have one of these situations where things are always being sucked together, plus the weak energy condition, then there is always a singularity to the future. So that's the idea of the singularity theorem. So it's trying to say that because GR is this highly nonlinear theory, and if you have a positive matter energy, then gravity wants to collapse. That's more or less what that's encoding. So, that's the general idea. So then we're led to worry about the consequences of a singularity. Because normally in physics, we have a set of equations of motion, and then we determine a solution of some physical setup, a solution of the equations of motion. So typically, we're dealing with wave equations. And so typically, what we do is we have an initial data surface, we specify initial data, and then we evolve forward into the future. And so we would like to know what happens in the future, and therefore we try and pick a data surface which will determine the whole of our future. So this is a Cauchy surface. And if we have a singularity which can impact on our space-time, then we've lost our evolution. We've lost our well-defined evolution. So that's the problem with having a singularity that is not cloaked. So, for example, if I have one of these black hole spacetimes where the black hole is formed due to gravitational collapse, then if I set up some data surface here, you can see that because the evolution of the equations of motion sort of follows, you can only influence things within your future light cone. And then if a point is up here, as long as the whole of its past light cone intersects that data surface, then you can say the physical system up here will be determined by the initial data on this segment evolved forward in time. So here we're okay, because if I evolve forward in time with this data surface, as far as my asymptotic observers are concerned, I always intersect with that data surface. So there's not a problem. But if I had a situation, for example, where I had this type of setup, then I would be in trouble, because if I tried to put another initial data surface there, this is a singularity now, that singularity is going to influence all of that part. Of Scribe Plus. So that's the sort of idea. What we want to avoid is a singularity that we can see, a naked singularity. So there's been a lot of activity in the classical GR community around this cosmic censorship hypothesis. So it's actually not generically true. So there's a sort of proliferation of strong and weak cosmic censorship and so on and so forth. But there's a general feeling that provided you set up a fairly generic physical situation, then it seems as if collapsing matter, if it's forming a singularity, will also form an event horizon. So there's no proof of that, because you can construct initial data which collapses to a singularity that doesn't have a horizon, but that tends to be rather artificial or very finely tuned. So a low cosmic censorship isn't sort of true in some sense. There's a notion that at least in generic situations, it's probably okay. So that's just it's something that there's sort of quite a bit of literature on, which, you know, is quite interesting, that we can't actually demonstrate that, you know, definitively, that event horizons always occur. What we can do, though, is to say, well, suppose we have a safe singularity, such as the one inside the Schwarzschild black hole, which is surrounded by an event horizon, is it secure? So if we have a safe one, is it secure? And that means, is a black hole stable? So that's a different way of thinking about cosmic censorship. So the other reason why you would want to know whether black holes were stable is because all around in our galaxy and throughout the universe, there are many, many black holes. If there was any problem with a black hole, such that it somehow went unstable and produced all of these naked singularities, then this would clearly have astrophysical and cosmological issues. So we want to be sure that these black holes are actually stable, so that, you know, they don't do anything unexpected cosmologically. And so this leads me to the topic of gravitational perturbation theory. In which we look at taking a known solution and adding an unknown small perturbation. So there's many situations where you want to use gravitational perturbation theory, and not just in testing stability of solutions. So it's quite a useful process to be aware of and to know, you know, the details of. So that's the idea. I'm going to just now derive dynamical equations, yep, for this perturbation. Mm-hmm. Ah, well, okay. So naked means that it's undressed, is the sort of, it's just a usage of word which means visible, okay? So it's this idea of something being visible. But I guess that's just the word that's usually used, because I suppose the idea is that what we really want is to have singularities hidden. And so it's bringing along this notion that we're all in this room dressed, right? So it would be quite shocking if one of us walked in with no clothes on. So it's that idea that the fact that the singularity being naked is something that is, you know, we don't expect and maybe don't want. Okay? So it's a choice of language, and it's expressing the fact that the singularity is visible. Okay? So that's what it's meaning there. Sorry? Visible means influences. So visible means I can see it, which means the light ray can come from it to me. So that means that there's a causal influence from the singularity, yeah? And then cloaked, that's using the notion of hidden. So that's, again, like, you know, cloaking device, okay? That's, again, just it's a choice of language, which means not visible. I don't know. I mean, sometimes people just sort of choose a word, maybe because they're being humorous. I mean, an example is the pea brains, which is sort of for a generic brain, which I remember. So when I was a student, one of my friends was working on symmetries of the sort of generic brain action. And at the time, the generic phrase for a brain was more or less up for grabs. And I know that Mike Duff and his sort of super gravity folk wanted to call them M-brains, which was like inverting the M-E of membranes, so E-M, so M-brains. But Paul Townsend, who was looking at the, you know, the action of these lower dimensional objects, rather liked the idea of P-brains, because then, you know, his paper could be super pea brains. And so it was just one of those things. And it was partly a joke, but it's kind of stuck. So it's just sometimes people just use words partly, you know, a bit tongue-in-cheek, and then they stick. And I think with singularities, it's just stuck as naked rather than visible, and cloaked rather than hidden, you know, causally disconnected or whatever. We've got to be allowed a bit of humor sometimes in the papers we write, okay? So what we're doing here is we are expanding. In H, keeping linear terms only. So this is going to be fairly familiar from when we were looking at the, you know, the Einstein action. But just to be annoying, this time I'm not looking at the variation of the inverse metric. I'm looking at the variation of the metric itself. And again, annoyingly, the variation of the metric is going to be called H, because H is conventionally used as the as sort of delta G in this context. It's just, again, one of those sort of fairly standard notations. But of course, you've also seen me write H as the first fundamental form in the Gauss-Kodaczy formalism, which is equally conventional. And so both sort of strands of usage of this H, you know, it's just one of those things. So you'll know from context which H it is. I'm not doing Gauss-Kodaczy here. So this H is a small perturbation of my background metric. So in finding the difference of the connection, obviously, I'm at the moment I've just written down, this is my full metric. G is G naught plus H. It shouldn't be an H naught there. Whereas for the inverse metric, obviously, that'll be a whole series in H, so there's going to be a whole power series in H. But to leading order, the inverse metric is just G minus H. And so I could then just expand this out and track through all the G naught comma BCs, and G naught BB comma Cs, and I would try and pull them together to make connection terms, or I can do the usual normal coordinate argument to say that this is just simply grad B of H A C plus grad C of H A B minus grad A of H B C. So the normal coordinate argument would be that the background connection vanishes, so all those terms are zero, which would mean what's in brackets is now already linear in H, so I get rid of that term. And then in normal coordinates, my comma goes to a semicolon, and what I've got left is now covariant, delta gamma is a tensor, and so if it's true in one frame, it's true in all frames. So that's the normal coordinate argument. So take your pick. And so this tells me if I want to look at the Ricci tensor again, remember the Ricci tensor is just going to be the change in the derivative terms of the connection, covariantized. And so I simply take all of these individual terms here and just write them down. So what I've done there is simply substituted in the expressions for delta gamma. But now what I'm going to do is, here I've got a C index, which could potentially contract with the H index. So I'm going to swap the order of differentiation. So that gives me a grad A, grad C. And then, but in swapping the order of differentiation, I'm using the Riemann identity, which means I have to take, for each free index, I've got to take a copy of the Riemann tensor contracted with H. So the final two indices are the two here. So that makes that a CA. So I'm replacing that C for this one. And then I replace the B. And then I do the same for the other term, which is really just this first term with A and B swapped. And then finally, I've got this term, which is box H. And then I've got minus grad A, grad B of the trace of H. So if I now group these terms together, I've got here I've got, let me see, where is it? So these two terms are both with the H contracting with the Riemann tensor, and because of the symmetries of the Riemann tensor, those two terms are actually identical. So I've just swapped the final two indices there, the price of a minus sign. My other terms, so that's taken care of this one and this one. Here, you see I've got the Ricci tensor because I'm contracting on the first and third indices. And so what I've got is, let's see. Actually, there's two of those, so I should have had a two there. So I've got a symmetrized contraction of the Ricci tensor with my perturbation here. And then the final part, I'm going to piece together as grad So I just have to define what that H bar is. Okay. So I've collected together the remaining terms. There's divergence of H, covariant derivative of symmetrized, and then the final piece, the second derivative of H, is encoded in this term here. So this whole thing here is obviously a second order differential operator, and we simply write it as a delta with a subscript L. And it's just known as the Lichnerowicz operator after the person, I guess, who wrote it down first. So that's the general curved space wave equation for a perturbation around a background. So you can see that the first term is what you'd expect, the wave operator. The second term is telling you about the sort of, or it's taking some of the free curvature of space-time into account. So that's making the wave, even though this wave operator here carries some information about curvature coming from the connection terms. This is also an extra part of the curvature. So in free vacuum space, both of these terms could potentially be non-zero. The third term is telling you about whether there's any matter. So that's your Ricci curvature. So there's a lot going on in this operator. And then it's the last term, which doesn't seem to look particularly what we might expect or want in if we were sort of trying to think about this HAB as some sort of spin 2 field. We expect a wave operator acting on it, but we maybe don't expect this bit, this mess, if you like, of covariant derivatives. So I want to have a look at that. And the fact that I bundled it together and said we don't necessarily expect it to be there should mean that it's no surprise that I'm going to now think about gauge and look at that last term. So So gauge or choice of coordinates is often absolutely critical in gravity. If you're trying to find exact solutions, your job is considerably simplified by choosing an appropriate gauge. And it's really no different when you're trying to perturb around exact solutions. So choosing a gauge is often almost all of the problem, you know, trying to find a good gauge for the situation that you're interested in. So let's look at what a gauge transformation is and what it does. So gauge transformations in GR are changes of coordinates. And locally, if you've just got a tiny change of coordinates, locally a change of coordinates can be represented by just moving a little bit along a vector field. So we saw this when we talked about the Lie derivative. We moved a little bit along a vector field as a means of taking a difference. So so locally, you could just write xA as going to xA plus xi, where xi is meant to be small somehow. And in that case, G changes by the Lie derivative of itself along that vector field. So again, we saw that when we were talking about Lie derivatives. So the Lie derivative we can write, if you remember, as the symmetrized covariant derivative of the vector field. So we saw that when we were looking at Killing vectors. And so that means that by doing this coordinate transformation, I've generated a perturbation, and a very specific perturbation. It's a perturbation which can be represented as the symmetrized derivative of a covector field. So this is one of the problems that you face when you're doing gravitational perturbation theory. The fact that you can generate a completely artificial perturbation by simply changing coordinates. So you can write flat space in a whole myriad of different ways, some of which may look like a little wave propagating through your flat space, but in fact it isn't. It's just a coordinate transformation which you've chosen to be periodic in nature. And so this is a real issue with gravity, is trying to decide what's physical and what's gauge. So if we look at our H bar, this well, it's trace reversed in four dimensions, but I guess not in general. Then my H bar is given in terms, again, of derivatives of xi. So I can ask, what is this expression now, this divergence of H? So So if I take the divergence, so I've split out that symmetrization on the of the derivative of psi, I get, again, the wave operator acting on this coordinate transformation. I've got two derivatives, and then I've got the gradient of the divergence of psi. So once again, I'm going to swap the order of differentiation here, because you can see that if I, you know, this term is basically equal to that term plus the Ricci tensor. So I'm simply doing a another one of those Riemann identities on my psi, swapping the order of differentiation here, but you can see that this is just the Ricci. So my, if I look at this now, just if I rewrite this down, so all I've done there is just simply said that if I've got a gauge transformation, I generate a perturbation, and the divergence of this h-bar coming from the perturbation has the form of a wave equation acting on a vector. So that I can now, what I know is that this is actually a well-posed differential equation. So if I instead said that if I start off with an HAB that has a non-zero divergence here, I can put that as a source in this wave equation here, and I can solve for a coordinate transformation which will subtract that non-zero divergence. I've sort of realized this may not have been the clearest expression, but basically, if you start off with an H which has non-zero divergence of H bar, you can do a coordinate transformation H psi so that the resulting H, H final, or H sort of initial plus the gauge transformation psi, now has vanishing trace, vanishing divergence of H bar. And so we're in a situation now where our Lichnerowicz operator just has terms that we know are sort of have a physical interpretation. We've got our wave operator, which is what we expect for a spin two field. We've got components of Riemann and Ricci curvature, which is perfectly okay in a curved background. And we've gotten rid of that last term, which turns out to be something which has no physical information. It's a gauge degree of freedom. So we've chosen a coordinate transformation to set that divergence of h bar to zero, and so we can ask ourselves whether there's any remaining gauge freedom. So if I had any gauge freedom left, I know what my h xi is. It has to satisfy that its divergence of the corresponding h bar is zero. So I have a coordinate transformation chi. So x goes to x plus chi, and I need to have that this combination vanishes, because this is the combination that corresponds to the divergence of h bar being zero. So I can do that, and there exists D. There exist D solutions to this equation. So yes, I do have gauge freedom left. It's a restricted gauge freedom, but there is nonetheless, if I have find solutions to this equation of motion, to this perturbation equation, I have to be aware that some of them are going to be gauge solutions, so not physical solutions. So let me just have a quick counting of degrees of freedom. HAB is symmetric in D dimensions. And so it has D into D plus 1 over 2 components. So I start off with D squared plus D on 2 degrees of freedom. I've then got a gauge constraint. So I have grad of H bar equals 0. So I'm constraining H. And I've got D of those constraints. And then if I ask what's my remaining gauge freedom, so of what remains, so that tells us we expect, as physical degrees of freedom, D into D plus 1 on 2, and then minus 2D. So this is what we expect as our physical degrees of freedom. So if we look at D equals 4, which we've already thought about from the perspective of having one of those plane gravitational waves, then I get 2. And that's exactly what we found for the plane-fronted gravitational waves. So we've got our plus and our cross-polarization states. In D equals 5, I get 5 degrees of freedom. So you can sort of think of that as sort of cross plus in sort of two independent planes plus a sort of diagonal component. But this now allows you in arbitrary dimensions to see how many degrees of freedom the graviton has. And so that's, you know, that's kind of, you see that it multiplies really, really quickly. So an application of this process of perturbation theory is simply to look at a background, for example, the Schwarzschild background, and to say, is it stable? Okay, so I just want to, I can't do this in detail because it's quite involved, but I want to sort of give a little bit of an idea. So in general, so in general, what you do is you use the symmetries of your background metric to try and reduce or separate the degrees of freedom of H. So this is exactly what you do if you were solving the wave equation just for a scalar field. So the most common thing you do there is simply to go into Fourier space. So if you're in flat space, you've got obviously the whole Poincaré group, and you would simply decompose with respect to sort of, you know, waves in the x, y, z direction and have an e to the I omega t. And so it's the same thing here. The only slight calculational issue is the fact that this is not a scalar field, it's a tensor field. It's not even a vector field. It's a tensor field. And so when you take the D'Alembertian of the tensor field, you've got an awful lot of terms which involve just the first derivative of H times connection components. So you see that you end up with, plus, of course, two connection components times H itself. So it's more complicated. So the issues of decomposing with respect to the background symmetries can be more complicated here. If you're in flat space, it's totally straightforward. It's just like doing scalar field because there's no Riemann, no Ricci, and no, if you choose your coordinates properly, no connection components for H. But, for example, if you wanted to look at black hole stability, then you would be in the situation where if you're looking at decomposing with respect to the SO3 symmetry group and looking at the angular momentum properties of your HAB, that's actually quite an involved process. So, so the process of computing the spin 2 spherical harmonics was done in the 50s by Reggie and Wheeler, and there's a whole expansion. You can write down components or the metric HAB in with sort of special where the different components of HAB are related to each other according to the angular momentum and spin of the particular mode of HAB. What I'd like to do in the remaining time, though, is to focus just on a single mode of perturbations, which are the spherically symmetric ones, and to show that although black holes in four dimensions were proven to be dynamically stable, once you go to higher dimensions, you end up with a very different answer indeed. So again, higher dimensional gravity with the greater numbers of degrees of freedom are showing up different properties to four dimensions. And in particular, this cosmic censorship, which seemed if a little bit creaky mathematically, trying to prove it as a proposal, at least from the perspective of stability of already cloaked singularities, that seemed to be cast iron in four dimensions, that once you had a singularity hidden behind event horizon, at least classically, it would remain there. That's no longer true classically in higher dimensions. So this is analyzing So in 4D, our black holes are stable. So it's in some sense, you could think of this from an entropic type of argument. What would happen? What process can you imagine that might split up black holes? So if you've got so I want to try and argue this not by going into detail on equations, but let me sort of say I've got a black hole of mass m and ask, what if I split it into two black holes of mass m on 2? What happens there? So my entropy, which we saw yesterday was looking like a quarter of the area, on this side, my entropy is proportional to 2m squared, I suppose I'll keep my 4 pi's actually. So I'm ignoring my g for the moment, so trying to fit this in. So my entropy is a quarter of the area, which is, it's obviously proportional to m squared, but my constant of proportionality is 4 pi. So an entropy of one of these smaller black holes is going to be pi, and then the Schwarzschild radius here is now m rather than 2m, so it's pi m squared. So over here, I've got an entropy of 4 pi m squared, whereas on this side, I've got an entropy of 2 pi m squared total. And so because this entropy is bigger than that, you do not expect that to be a physical process. However, if I look at my black string in 5 dimensions, so I'm imagining I've got a Kaluza-Klein compactification of length L, then the mass is proportional to the 4-dimensional Schwarzschild radius R plus, and also the length of the black string. Which happens to equal just r plus over 2g4. So it's the sort of normal. I've had to put my g's back in here because I'm going flipping between dimensions. And its entropy again, area 4 pi r plus squared l, and then I've got to divide by 4g5. So that's the mass and entropy of the black string. But now if I compare that to a 5-dimensional Schwarzschild black hole with radius R5, my mass here ends up being proportional to R5 squared, because in five-dimensional Schwarzschild, my Newtonian potential is 1 minus R5 on R squared. So my mass is proportional to R5 squared, and then there's some constants, which are not really relevant. And the entropy is now proportional to the cube of R5. So in terms of the string, your entropy is looking like sort of something with a mass squared and then some powers of L, whereas here it's a different function of the mass. So we have a different dependence of the entropy on the mass of the object. So we've got that S black string looks like M squared, whereas S black hole looks like M to the 3/2. So there's a difference dependence on the mass. So if I am in five dimensions and I have a certain amount of mass, I could either clock it into a string or a hole, and which one is preferred should be the one with higher entropy. So you can see that there's something going on here. Maybe there's a sort of crossover point. So let's see when the two entropies are actually equal. So that's the this is the entropy here of the black string. I've simply replaced R plus in terms of the mass. So you can see I've got sort of various numerical factors, which I'm not perhaps necessarily interested in. But what I end up with is so I've tried to compare the mass. So I've said that I've got an equal mass of black string and black hole. I'm looking at the entropies, and I'm sort of looking at a crossover point where the entropies are the same. And so on the left-hand side, you can see that you've got this dependence of the sort of G4m squared times the length, whereas on the right-hand side, you've got, again, mass to the 3/2, and with a sort of square root of the five-dimensional Newton's constant. And so for small lengths, you find that the black string has higher entropy and is therefore preferred, but for large lengths, the black hole has higher entropy and is therefore preserved. And so the entropic argument indicates that black holes are preferred. And so you can test this in perturbation theory. And you look at a spherically symmetric H. So once again, you are decomposing with respect to the background symmetries. So the instability occurs as a spherically symmetric. So this is the z direction. This is the space-time direction, 0, 1, 2, 3. And the instability occurs as a sort of wave coming along the string like this. So the black string becomes a sort of wobbly black hole, two leading order. And the reason we know it's a physical instability and not a gauge instability is because the presence of this e to the I mu z term gives us something that looks like the Lichnerowicz operator plus a mass term. It gives us something looking like a mass term for the four-dimensional mode. So this is just four, this is something that's happening in the directions of the black hole itself, so the r theta phi t, and it's something that's causing the black hole to wobble. If it were a pure gauge mode, then a pure gauge mode in 4D would satisfy Lichnerowicz acting on the gauge mode equals zero. But it's not zero because of that mu mass term. So this is just a perturbative argument, but I'd like to show you what happens non-perturbatively. And this is work, I hope this is going to work, that was done by Louis Lehner here at Perimeter. So this is like showcasing some Perimeter work. And this is now a full nonlinear numerical simulation of this five-dimensional black string. So what you're seeing here, this green blob, is the black string as it sort of initially starts. Uh-oh, what have I done there? Whee. There we go. So the black string is initially just a string. The instability starts. It's in its linear mode. It very rapidly becomes nonlinear. And you can see that what it looks like is it's forming the black hole, which is what's entropically preferred. But I think what we didn't expect was what you're seeing now, which is this scaling, this hierarchy of scales. You initially form two big blobs, but then the string in the middle keeps on going unstable and starts forming smaller blobs, smaller black holes. And so you get this, what we know is a sort of, or call a scaling solution, where as you focus in at smaller and smaller scales, it keeps repeating itself. So on the right, which hopefully I'll get right, this is kind of focusing in. So it's zooming in on what's going on. So there the instabilities started, but now it's hierarchically happening again and again. And so you get smaller and smaller little black holes forming as beads along the location of the initial string. So this is kind of a really neat result because we found the black string instability 20 years ago, but there was absolutely no way of proving it computationally because of the amount of computational power that was required. And so although, I don't know if you're watching the time counter, it's kind of slowing down as you're looking at this hierarchical structure forming, the clock is slowing. But roughly speaking, to go each unit of scale down, you're sort of take, even though your time, the amount of evolution of asymptotic time has dropped, it's still taking the same amount of computational time. So this is an absolutely enormous computational project. So it's sort of one of the, I think, the showpieces, if you like, of higher dimensional numerical gravity, dynamical numerical gravity. So it's what those guys do for fun when they're not calculating binary mergers. Okay, so that's today's lecture. And tomorrow I'll talk about another current application of gravitational physics, and that is sort of look at how gravity has applications in string theory.